This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Monday seems so long ago now, doesn't it? We'll make sense of the week that was coming up. Also, why budget people get big jobs in Washington. And my personal favorite today, comic book economics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 11th of April today. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. Friday, which can only mean one thing. 4 minutes of live radio in which we figure out what the heck happened in the 5 days gone by. For that, we've got Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He is in Washington, D.C. In our New York bureau is Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so Lee, I will go no farther than this to start the questioning this afternoon. Wall Street, hello. It's been a tricky, tricky week.
It has been. It has been. And it's been a bit more than a week as well.
Yeah.
We're seeing this increasing skittishness, and whether it's related to Candy Crush's IPO or tech stocks this week or JP Morgan today.
Yeah.
I think what we're seeing is just, if you pull really far back, last year, the market was pretty boffo. I mean, it was up 30%, and I think the whole world knows that we're not going to do that again this year.
Boffo,
I'm not a fortune teller, but I think that's a pretty safe assumption. I'm sorry, I'll just say it.
No, I think that's all right. I think that's good.
And so there's all this skittishness and fear, and that's what we're seeing.
Sudeep, one of my favorite lines ever is context is everything, and we do need to remember that even though it's been a tough 10 days, 2 weeks, we went bananas last year, and so this is honestly, relatively speaking, nothing.
Bananas, boffo. I'll give you another B word, bubble. We spent so much time.
Oh, no, you went there.
We spent so much time, though, thinking about bubbles. Was the stock market in a bubble? Is it not in a bubble? That we've actually lost sight of some of the more fundamental issues like corporate earnings and economic expectations. And we actually would need to see some pretty remarkable economic growth and profit growth to support where the stock market has been for the last few months. And so coming off a couple of percent shouldn't really seem like that big of a deal, considering, as you said, where we've gone over the last year.
Excellent points all, but let me ask you this, Lee. We haven't even really started with corporate profit season, right? I mean, yes, we had JP Morgan this morning down 19% in earnings, but and we'll get there in a minute. But the news is yet to come, and still investors are a little volatile, shall we say.
That's absolutely true. And, maybe we'll have some surprises to the upside in the batch, but there may be. Certainly what Sudeep said is spot on. I mean, now the earnings and the kind of, the performance of these companies has to sustain these stock prices and these valuations. And, everyone's cut costs and been so much more, extracted so much more productivity. But there's only so much you can do once you start to kind of lap those efficiencies. So that's a good point. We're only in the beginning.
Sudeep, the Washington story this week, yesterday, in fact, Secretary Sebelius is going to resign or has resigned. I guess it was announced today by the president, and we're going to have David Gura on that coming up in just a sec. What do you make, though, of what this might mean for the ACA, for Obamacare, and for anything substantive? Anything?
For anything substantive, we have to look a lot longer down the road. This is just another stage in the political torture that we go through in the rollout of something like this. It is a big step. Obviously, trying to transform and overhaul our healthcare system is huge. What's just absolutely crazy here is that we are in such the truly earliest stages of implementation. It's 6 months into this program, and people's heads are about to fall off over how over what's happening here. We don't know how the ACA is going to be affecting healthcare costs. We don't know how it's affecting premiums for companies, for individuals down the line. These things are going to take years, if not decades, to understand. And we have gone through this much pain in the first 6 months of just trying to get through the rollout. Yeah. It doesn't. It kind of scares me about what's to come on the political front there. But for the substance of it, it's something that we're just going to have to watch as we get some of the data when people are enrolled in these plans.
All right. More to come from David Gurna on that in about, 45 seconds or so, Lee. But let me just touch briefly on the earnings news of the day. JPMorgan Chase, the biggest and now somehow not the most profitable bank in this country. Does that portend bad things for the banking sector, which, as we all know, is huge?
You know, it's not great. I mean, what's significant here is that this isn't just kind of due to legal expenses or regulatory costs, but this is really about, a slowdown in the bank's fundamental areas, trading and loan demand. And even though, Wells Fargo reported much better results today, but even their mortgage banking income fell, and it was subsidized by gains on the commercial real estate side and the auto loan side. So, I think that I think it's something to pay attention to.
All right, fair enough. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He's down in Washington. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll talk to you next time. On Wall Street today, it was interesting, we'll say that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This was one of those Rose Garden presidential announcement kinds of days in Washington, D.C. President Obama made official the news that broke last night, as I said a minute ago. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is out. Budget Chief Sylvia Matthews-Burwell is in, although there is still that small matter of a Senate confirmation to handle. At the moment, Burwell is the director of the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB in the Washington parlance, which is one of the wonkier agencies in a very wonky town. It is also, though, something of a proving ground. Heads of the OMB not infrequently go on to become White House chiefs of staff and cabinet secretaries. Marketplace's David Gurra has that story.
The director of the Office of Management and Budget oversees about 500 employees, most of whom are career civil servants. It was Alice Rivlin's job back when Bill Clinton was president.
It isn't such a big agency, but the subject matter covers everything that the government does.
And if you can run the OMB, she says, you can run anything. The head of the agency works with the president, drafting his budget and reviewing regulations. And there are countless meetings, Rivlin says, with lawmakers and with other cabinet members.
What you do all day is move from one issue to another.
The first hour of the day will be health care reform. The next hour will be clean energy. The next hour will be international taxation.
Jeff Liebman's a public policy professor at Harvard, but he used to be the acting deputy director of OMB. He says it's a training ground for other jobs in government. Leon Panetta went on to become the head of the CIA, then Secretary of Defense. Mitch Daniels became the governor of Indiana, then the president of Purdue. Joshua Bolton ran OMB for President George W. Bush.
It's both a grinding and a fascinating job.
And after a few years doing that, Bolton got a promotion. He became the president's chief of staff, a move that several OMB directors have made.
It's the opportunity to interact on so many issues at a senior level that I think puts former budget directors in a good position for other jobs.
That and experience as a manager. Jim Capretta was an associate director of OMB.
You're trying to get a whole bunch of people marching in the same direction.
If Sylvia Matthews-Burwell's confirmed as Secretary of Health and Human Services, she'd have to do the same thing, but she'd oversee about 150 times as many people. In Washington, I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
Walmart is getting into organics, about 100 items in all, marketed under the name Wild Oats. This being Walmart, the idea is that they will be cheap, the same price as non-organics on Walmart shelves, which is to say Wild Oats spaghetti sauce would cost the same as Ragu. But you got to do the math. There just isn't a huge supply of organic commodity crops out there. In fact, prices for organic wheat and corn have been going up. So where is Walmart going to get its organic ingredients while keeping those prices infamously low? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has been asking around.
It's one thing to try to grow demand for organics by offering lower prices. Supplying that demand could be tough. Tim Daly buys and sells organic soybeans for Stonebridge, a broker in Iowa.
There's not as many acres. 3 to 4% of the marketplace is organic, and a lot of that is still coming in from offshore.
If not for imports, he says, prices would be even higher.
And they're already high. So if you have $14 soybeans on the Chicago Board of Trade, you easily have anywhere from $24 to $28 soybeans.
That's organic soybeans. Increasing supply can't happen overnight. Kelly James is the founder of Mercaris. Her company supplies market data on organic commodities.
It takes 3 years for a producer to achieve organic certification. So even if tomorrow prices go up or a producer decides he or she wants to grow, let's say organic wheat, it's going to take 3 years before that new supply is ready to come online.
And how will Walmart get the price it wants from farmers? The company says it plans to lock in 5-year contracts. Paul Mitchell isn't sure that'll work. He teaches agricultural economics at the University of Wisconsin. If market prices go up elsewhere, then producers...
they're going to demand a higher price from Walmart. Say, look, Walmart, we sold you our can of corn at $1.50 a can, organic. Now all of a sudden the market price is $2. Well, we don't want the $1.50 anymore. We want to sell it for $2.
And if they don't get it? Tim Daly, the soybean broker, says he's seen beans under contract magically disappear. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Amazon announced this week it's bought a company called Comixology. That's an online store and digital reader for comic books and graphic novels and the like. There are those of you comic book, nerds specifically, for whom that will mean quite a bit more than it means to, say, the rest of us. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark was firmly in that the rest of us camp until today. So here she is with the economics of comics.
To all you comics fans, I apologize. I am not one of you. Or I haven't been. Then today, I called up Douglas Walk, a comic book writer working on a series called Judge Dredd Mega City 2.
It's probably the closest that incredibly violent sci-fi gets to a tribute to Joan Didion.
And now I'm intrigued. Walk says part of why he can write crazy mashups like this is because of the weird way the comic books business has worked for many years.
Comics have the strangest economics of just about any medium I can think of.
Unlike regular books, where stores can return unsold copies, with comics, a store buys a certain number from a publisher on a non-refundable basis. That means comic publishers know ahead of time how many copies will be profitable to print, so it's easier to take risks in niche markets. And those markets have become even easier to tap with the rise of digital comics, according to Calvin Reed at Publishers Weekly. He says sales for physical comic books have already plateaued.
Even in the early 90s, there were comics that hit real mass market numbers, a million or so. But, now 100,000 copies, everyone pays attention.
Even so, physical comics that you can hold in your hand are still a more than $600 million industry. There's just something addictive about flipping through the pages, says Jeff Ayers. He's a manager at a comic book store in Manhattan called Forbidden Planet. And he says it's great to be able to read a comic on your phone, but...
I'm not inclined to really kind of bring my phone into the bathtub where I would be a comic book and to
a
read,
bathtub, Do you read? Is that a favorite place?
Yeah. That is a favorite place.
I just might try that. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up, which page do you choose?
Turn to page 5 and be trapped in a cave, or turn to page 6 and take a different route.
The story behind the Choose Your Own Adventure books. But first, let's do the numbers. There they are, the Wawa trombones. I knew they were coming. The Dow Industrials off 143 points today, about 0.9%, closed at 16,026. The NASDAQ dropped 54 points, 1.3%. Finished at 39.99. The S&P 500 down 17 points, nearly a full percent. Ended things at 18.15. For the week gone by, the Dow off 2.3%. The NASDAQ shaved off 3.1%. The S&P 500 shanked 2.6%. Shares in JPMorgan Chase traded down 3.2%. After that weaker-than-expected earnings report this morning that we told you about, JPM was not alone. Bank of America off 2.1% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell a bit more, down to 2.62%. You're listening to MarketPlace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports retail sales data for March. Otherwise, things may be a tad quiet on Capitol Hill, with Congress scheduled to be out on recess. And on April 14, 1910, President William Howard Taft became the first president to throw out the first pitch of the baseball season. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You hold in your hands, or more accurately, you have in your pocket or your purse, a valuable example of the latest and greatest technology. And people being people, they want to steal it. We are, of course, talking smartphones here, and theft is a very real problem. One possible solution is what's called a kill switch, a way to disable the thing if and or when it gets taken. Something like that would, proponents say, reduce the number of phones that are stolen and in the process save us smartphone users a whole lot of money. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Thieves want your smartphone. Really, really want it. Consumer Reports estimates 1.6 million smartphones were stolen in 2012. Rob DeVideo is a criminal justice professor at Drexel University.
In some cities, a majority of the reported thefts are for smartphones and other mobile computing devices.
He thinks a kill switch that would allow you to disable your phone could make a lot of sense. A bricked-up phone isn't worth much to a bad guy. But the ability to kill a phone could be worth a whole lot to me and you. William Duckworth is a statistician at Creighton University.
People who formerly had their phone stolen, they won't have that happen anymore, and so they won't have to go out and buy a new phone.
And he says if there's a lot less theft, we wouldn't have to pay as much to insure our phones. Altogether, says Duckworth, a kill switch could save customers
$2.6 billion savings annually.
That's a lot of money, and it doesn't include the time police spend. Here's DeVideo again.
When you look at the rate of thefts of smartphones in major metropolitan areas in the United States, it's just taxing law enforcement resources.
He thinks it's just a matter of time before all phones come with kill switches. Apple's newest operating system allows users to shut down phones remotely. And according to Duckworth's research, it's something 99% of us smartphone users want. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
When one talks fashion, as we do here from time to time, one has to know the vocabulary, the lingo, if you will. Today's thesaurus entry is upscale, and it means, apparently, something other than what I always thought it meant, which was really expensive. Today's lesson comes to us courtesy of the Swedish retailer H&M. They are opening a brand new couple of stores in New York and L.A. this month under a new brand. It's called COS. So for another installment of Fashion Tutoring, we have called fashion writer Kate Betts. Hey, Kate, how are you?
Good. How are you, Kai?
I am good. So this idea, I want to talk about two things. This idea of fast fashion and specifically this new H&M thing, COS, that's coming to New York and L.A.
COS.
Is that what it's called? COS?
I think so, yeah.
I'm so not hip. I can't even get the name right.
Let me forgive you.
It's part of H&M, right? So first of all, it's like the upscale line?
Correct.
Is it also, when I say upscale, do I also mean more expensive?
It's a little bit more expensive than H&M, but I think what's interesting about it is it's, you know, H&M is very young and mm-hmm. very trendy and changes all the time. And this is targeted towards an older consumer. And when I say older, I don't mean, you know, octogenarians,
right,
although
right
possibly. I think it's really targeted towards a boomer market, even though younger people are wearing it too. And I think that's where they're going to really hit a home run.
Oh, do you really? You think it's going to be a smash?
Yeah, I
do. How come?
It's really wearable and it's fashion. It's not basics, but it's much less expensive. And it's hip in a way that I don't think fast fashion has had this kind of hip attitude before.
You say less expensive. I see a coat on this website for $300.
Right. I say less expensive than the designer market, Kai.
Yeah.
It's all relative.
So clearly I'm just cheap.
Exactly.
Oh, that hurts.
You're shopping at H&M, I guess.
Well, no, I'm not.
Us.
But we're not getting into my shopping habits. The demand for this, though, is clearly there, right?
Yeah, it's clearly there because I think there are a lot of women who could afford to buy Prada, Marnie, and Jill Sander, but they don't want to pay that price anymore. The retailers, department stores, have given women the habit of buying everything on sale. So they're not going to pay full price for anything anymore. You know,
that is so interesting because we talk a lot in other contexts about consumers being used to the perpetual sale and not being willing to pay top dollar. Does this then translate into just we are all getting more price conscious?
Yeah, totally. And we're all looking for a great deal. I mean, this is like a badge of honor, you know, to go out there and say, hey, I got this great looking coat. It looks just like Prada, but I only paid $300 for it. Now, I know you're going to make a joke about that guy and say only $300.
I was going to skip it.
As opposed to $2,000 for a similar coat at Prada.
Kate Betts, her book is called Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. We have called her, as we always do, when I have questions about fashion. Kate, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
There's a certain slice of the population, say 30 to 45 or so, for which four words can bring back their childhood. Choose your own adventure. It's a book series that started 35 years ago. There are almost 200 titles, more than $50 million in sales, and I don't know how many readers out there. The story of how it began comes thanks to our new collaboration with Mental Floss magazine. Before computers, before video games, there was a lawyer who thought books ought to be more interactive and two women who took a chance when everybody else said no.
Hello, this is Edward Packard. I more or less invented Choose Your Own Adventure, and that's why I'm here today. It really begins about 1969 when I was making up bedtime stories for my kids. I had a character named Pete, and this character landed on a desert island, and I actually couldn't think of what would happen next in the story. I was tired from a long day of work. So I said, Caroline and Andrea, oh, what would you do if you were Pete in this situation? I got two different answers. I felt that, you know, this could be quite a big thing. I started writing it on the train while I was commuting to New York. I worked out multiple stories, depending on what Pete would do, except instead of writing about Pete, I wanted to write about you. I had a friend who was in the publishing business, and he showed it to his children's book editor, but she turned it down. It was just too strange and too new. And I came back, and I put it in the desk drawer because I said, well, it just isn't going to work. It was about 10 years.
I'm Joelle Del Borgo, and I'm a literary agent.
My name is Amy Burkhauer. I'm a literary agent.
Amy called me on the phone, and she told me she had something she was very excited about that she wanted me to take a look at, and it was The Cave of Time.
It is a time machine book, and instead of going into a machine, the cave becomes the vehicle.
And at every twist and turn in the plot, you, the reader, were empowered to make a choice.
Turn to page 5 and be trapped in a cave, or turn to page 6 and take a different route.
A light bulb went off, and I called her back and I said, Amy, this isn't a book deal. This is a series. I had to get my company on board, and fortunately, I got a call. It was from the assistant to the chairman of Bantam Books, Oscar Distel. And she said, Oscar wants to see you. And I was just terrified. But I went. It felt to me like I had to walk miles to get to his desk. And he just sort of barked at me and said, I understand that you've read something that's going to change the way that kids read, and I want to know what it is.
From then on, it was off to the races.
Now we had to fan the flames and get the world to know what we were doing. I remember an article in the New York Times that said these books were as contagious as chickenpox. And at that moment, I knew these books really were going to be as successful as I had hoped and dreamed.
I remember the letters from kids were about, you know, how they loved to die and to be able to come back again.
Very quickly, Bantam realized that the market would sustain one a month.
After a while, it did get too demanding. Bantam decided that, you know, it would be okay if it helped find other authors to write the books.
One of the strengths of the early books is that there were just the right number of endings. And I think that as the series evolved, that kind of got watered down a little bit. Perhaps the gatekeepers weren't as stringent about the criteria.
We knew the sales were declining. Not only was interactivity and computers and computer games supplanting these books in part, but also we lost a lot of girl readers, I think, when a series called Babysitter's Club became very popular.
20 years after the first book was published, the series ended.
It's always sad to see the demise or faltering of something that you really care about. Sometimes you do have to stop and let something go. Ed Packard, hats off to him. This was a concept that evolved when he was just telling his kids a bedside story. And that was the pure genius of it.
I think you got about all I have to say.
You can read the whole story in the latest issue of Mental Floss magazine, or you can click on the link to the article, which is on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which Congress discovers the amazing powers of the Internet and which also about, I am not kidding, from the Congressional Record, this item, Senate Bill S-2206, introduced just last week, which the legislative language tells us can be cited as the Let Me Google That For You Act of 2014. It would, in all seriousness, abolish the National Technical Information Service, collector and disseminator of almost 3 million government, scientific, technical, engineering, and business reports because, yes, and we all knew this, you can just Google them for nothing. All right, we're done. That's it. That's Marketplace from APM this Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Orr. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. Y'all know my name. I'll be back on Monday. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.